Welcome to the Perp Web Podcast, hosted by Joe Bosch.
Sure, okay. All right, so my talk today is on cannabis and that it's not just for getting high. So before I kind of get into cannabis, because the real question is it real medicine or is it snake oil? And so enter Clark Stanley. Clark Stanley, as you see here, made rattlesnake oil liniment. And it was good for a whole host of things. It was the strongest and best liniment known for the cure of all pain and lameness. So if you were lame, you could use this. It was only for external use, so keep that in mind. Rheumatism, neuralgia, sciatica, lame back, lumbago, I don't know what that is, contracted muscles, toothache, so I guess you could put it on the outside, sprains, swelling, frostbite, chilblains, I'm not sure what that is either, bruises, sore throat, bites of animals and insects and reptiles. It gives immediate relief. It gives immediate, it for sale by all dealers in medicine. Price is 50 cents per bottle. And it's manufactured by Clark Stanley, Providence, Rhode Island. So we've all heard, that's snake oil. And the question is cannabis medicine or is it snake oil? So I want to explore what snake oil, where that all came from. And in the 1800s, thousands of Chinese workers arrived here in the United States as indentured laborers to work on the Transcontinental Railroad. The vast majority of these workers came from peasant families in southeastern China and were signed to contracts that ran up to 5 years for relatively low wages. Among the items the Chinese railroad workers brought with them were various different medicines, including snake oil. This oil was made from the oil of the Chinese water snake. That's very important. It was the Chinese water snake, which was very high in omega-3. And of course, this reduced inflammation. The Chinese water snake oil, in its original form, was really very effective, especially when used to treat, you know, the common ailments you would get from working on the railroad. You know, they feel like they got the arthritis, the bursitis, whatever, sore muscles. So the story goes that the Chinese workers shared the oil with their American counterparts, who marveled at how well it worked. Well, eventually, Clark Stanley got wind of this mystery oil, and being the entrepreneur that he was, figured that he could make and sell the same thing. The only problem was, where could he get Chinese water snakes? So he substituted Chinese water snakes for rattlesnakes. There it is, Clark Stanley's rattlesnake oil liniment. The former self-professed cowboy claimed he had learned about the healing power of rattlesnake oil from Hopi medicine man. He never publicly mentioned Chinese snake oil at all. Stanley created a huge stir at the 1893 World's Exposition in Chicago when he took a live rattlesnake, and sliced it open before a crowd of onlookers. Of course, not only didn't these rattlesnakes contain much of the valuable omega-3 that the Chinese rattlesnake did, but they were also quite venomous. And as Clark Stanley was soon to find out, supply could not even come close to meeting demand for his miracle product, which at the time was selling very well. So what he did to resolve this was tinker with his original formula. And in comes chief chemist Harvey Washington Wiley, MD. By 1906, the Pure Food and Drug Act had been passed and tough new standards were put in place to prevent the sale of adulterated foods and medications. The Department of Agriculture established a poison squad headed up by chief chemist Harvey Washington Wiley. They conducted stringent testing of a wide range of different products being sold in the public. This was the precursor, Pure Foods, of the FDA, which we know of today, and that was name was changed to the FDA officially in 1930. But because there was so much public demand and political resistance and pressure, it wasn't until 1917 when government inspectors finally seized a shipment of Clark Stanley's snake liniment and conducted a thorough analysis of its contents. What they discovered was that Clark Stanley snake oil liniment didn't contain any snake product whatsoever. According to the official report, the bottles contained a rather bizarre mixture of mineral oil, camphor, cayenne pepper, animal fat, and turpentine. While Stanley was charged under the Pure Food and Drug Act for misbranding his product, all that amounted to was a measly $20 fine. Still, the government report helped to kill the demand for Stanley's product, the snake oil liniment, and he found himself out of business. But even though the scam was found out, he went out of business as a rather rich man and faded later into obscurity. So it's very interesting, and it's also, this is actually very prescient, that in 1927, Harvey Washington Wiley, this is 1927, expressed his suspicions that the use of any form of tobacco may be or might be harmful and that it might promote cancer. Because of mounting evidence confirming Wiley's early warnings, Good Housekeeping stopped accepting cigarette ads in 1952, 12 years before the U.S. Surgeon General issued a report detailing the health hazards of smoking. In his last year, by the way, he was the first director of the FDA. He fought and won the battle to keep refined sugar pure and unadulterated. He died in 1930 at age 86, and he was given a Patriot's funeral at Arlington Cemetery. That's a big deal. This guy was serious. And the whole problem, and you're going to see this throughout my talk, is that you'll find there's a lot of this, all of what I just described to you, in the snake oil world. Did I show this on the slide? See, you guys got to tell me when I mess up. There's Chief Chemist Harvey Wiley Washington. Sorry about that, guys. So, marijuana in the 1930s was considered to be a scourge. You had wild orgies and wild parties, or weird orgies. It results in lust, crime, sorrow, hate, shame, despair, misery. You see as a needle. You see the woman who looks like she's got a cigarette, assuming it's a marijuana cigarette, and her life is just ruined because she is, you know, clearly going to weird orgies and wild parties. But when we talk about cannabis, we have to look at it from the familial and the genus, and then to the various different functional and hierarchy and dysfunctional hierarchy. So the Rutaceae family has citrus, and of course you go down, and citrus can be sweet or sour. So it could be a lemon or it can be an orange. The Cannabaceae family, which has cannabis, can have indica, sativa, or ruderalis. But when you dig down to the dysfunctional hierarchy in that cannabis genus, there's hemp and there's marijuana. Really, they're almost indistinguishable. In fact, they are indistinguishable. The only thing in cannabinoids that differentiates cannabis from being hemp, or whether it is marijuana is whether its primary ingredient, as you see on the left, is the cannabidiol or the CBD, or if its primary ingredient, which you see on the right, which is the marijuana, is THC, tetrahydrocannabinol. So we all heard of that. That's what makes you high. So if it has a THC content that is less than 0.3%, it's hemp. If it has a THC content of 20% or greater, it is marijuana. And that is all that differentiates the two. Now you notice the CBD content in hemp is higher, double higher, but the THC content in marijuana is way more than double that of hemp. So to make this a little more complicated and confusing, we're going to take two species of cannabis, and in this case they are talking about THC levels of 20% or higher. So this is marijuana. Well, if you look at the sativa, they're taller and slimmer plants, and the leaves are longer and thinner. It gives you a head high. You are more alert. You're uplifted and euphoric. You have increased creativity. And it is best for daytime use, you know, like before you go to work. The indica, on the other hand, is shorter and bushier plant. The leaves are shorter and wider. It gives you a body high. It relaxes you. It's an appetite stimulator. It's a sleep aid. It's a pain reliever. And it's best for nighttime use. So I don't know if you see where I'm going with this, but where I'm going with this is that I see a lot of the same marketing strategy from Clark Stanley. It's for everything. And I'm going to show you some more of that here as we move along. But it's not to say that botanicals or plants are not commonly used in medicine and that there is not real medicine in this, because there is, and I'm going to show you that. But you got to think, you know, okay, just going through a very short list. You've got the angel trumpet, and that's a very powerful hallucinogenic, can be misused or abused, but that's where we get atropine and scopolamine from. Sweet clover, we get warfarin. Ephedra sinica, that's dual purpose as well as a decongestant, but it can be it's the base product of methamphetamine. The coca leaf, it's to relieve hunger and fatigue. They chew the plants or they chew the leaves, but it's also used for treating nausea and asthma. Coca tea is used for altitude sickness in the Peruvian Andes and elsewhere. And then you have Penicillium mold. Okay, so you know, there's in that world, we get a lot and have gotten a lot of medicines. And that kind of medicine is really well accepted, I think, throughout history as actually having value. The question is cannabis, should it be used as it's shown here, or should it be the components synthesized? What really does work, what doesn't work? So again, you look at the economy, and economy matters. Hemp's on the left, marijuana's on the right. Cannabis sativa is the species. You see the psychoactive content, 0.3 versus 10%. The hemp is used for auto parts, soap, concrete. I'll show you some more things it's used for. The one on the right is used for getting high. That's its purpose. And look at the estimated domestic violence, or domestic market value, I'm sorry, in euros. 452 million for hemp, 10 billion to 120 billion for marijuana. That's a big spread, but that's more than likely because a lot of it is underground money. But that's if you just took the low number, 10 billion versus 452 million, just take that, and that's a remarkable, I think that's a 20-fold difference. So that's quite substantial. And when I told you earlier that hemp and marijuana were essentially indistinguishable from each other, well, here's a photo posted from the New York Police Department 75th Precinct Twitter feed showing officers with what they thought was 106 pounds of marijuana. And they looked pretty happy there, pretty proud. One guy's smiling. Other guy looks like he's got two bags. He's looking on this, you know, holding them like babies. They look happy. But it was hemp. It was perfectly legal. Here is a U-Haul truck with a haul full of 3,300 plus pounds of marijuana. Guy spent a month in jail. Lab test came back. It was legal hemp. So you can't tell the difference between the two. They're indistinguishable. So let's look at hemp in regards to what its history is. It is known to have over 50,000 different uses in textiles, industrial textiles, paper, foods, building materials, and body care. I mean, everything from clothing, soaps and shampoos, printing, newspaper, you name it. So it has a tremendous amount of utility and use. And again, the only difference is its THC content is 0.3% or less, just not enough to get you and to be worth getting. You have to smoke too much of it to get high. There's also evidence that there's material, though they've actually found material that dates 10,000 years made from hemp, and it is believed to be the first crop ever cultivated by mankind. And I thought that was sort of an interesting factoid. Its molecular structure between cannabidiol and tetrahydrocannabinol, which you see here, the cannabidiol is the CBD, which is the hemp, and you see it has an extra hydrogen atom. You look over at the hydrocannabinol, and you see that's missing. There's some minor other differences, but their molecular structure is very, 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 very similar. So what is the evidence of cannabis in health and disease? This study done from Israel. So cannabis preparations have been used in medicine for millennia. However, concerns over the dangers of abuse led to the banning of the medicinal use of marijuana in most countries in the 30s. I showed you that ad. They really felt it was a scourge. They didn't want to use it. In 1840, Schlesinger was the first apparent investigator to obtain an active extract from the leaves and flower of hemp. But it wasn't until 1964 that THC, the major, of course, psychoactive component of cannabis, was isolated in pure form, and its structure was then understood. Shortly after that was synthesized, it became widely available. These chemical advances led to an avalanche of publications on THC, as well as CBD, and the non-psychoactive plant cannabinoid. However, concern about the dangers of abuse led to the banning of marijuana and its constituents from medicinal use in the United States and many other countries in the 30s and 40s. It took decades until cannabinoids came to be considered again as compounds of therapeutic value, and even now their use is still very highly restricted. Although that's from this study, that's changed because marijuana is getting is legal a lot of places. I mean, marijuana is legal. CBD is just legal. Marijuana is legal a lot of places now, so recreational use. And there's some questions about its safety, but let's get into the study because they discussed that. There is some dependency associated with marijuana. It seems to be more prevalent if they started early, but the dependency is also generally found in personality types of addicted people. It can easily be successfully reversed. There's really no major withdrawal symptoms. And it works on the brain, you know, reward process, you know, typical of all of these things, probably alkaloids. It's the dopamine receptors, as we see in most of these kinds of things. There are some negative effects to cannabis, and these can be related to alterations of attention and cognitive functions or other neuropsychological and behavioral effects. Again, found mostly if the person is either adolescent or began smoking in adolescence. That's kind of a key metric here. You know, I would say, like drinking, our drinking age is 21 for a variety of reasons. Maybe that, you know, as this becomes legal, we need to also more legal in more places. We may have to make sure that there's some kind of age associated with them. People are going to get it. I was getting alcohol when I was 13 years old. There is some electrophysiological measures have revealed long-term deficits in attention among cannabis users, impairment in both cognitive function and mood following cannabis use. However, says here, the other studies did not really support that. So there's not strong evidence that you really have electrophysiological or cognitive or mood dysfunction with cannabis use. That just isn't there. There are some studies that have shown evidence that cannabis use may trigger an acute schizophrenic psychosis. That seems odd. I would say it's probably laced with something. Now, this was one that really got my attention. Amotivational syndrome. I don't really think that exists, but it was described in 1960 among patients with a history of long-time cannabis use. That sounds like one of those made-up syndromes, amotivational syndrome. So it's a stoner, so we're going to say he has amotivation. We have to give somebody a diagnosis, so that's it. The data from other studies, however, did not support this hypothesis. So again, the data is very mixed, and it was very biased towards the time. Most of these studies were done at a time when the country was very divided amongst between hippies and between preppies and, you know, who used pot and who didn't and all this kind of stuff. But cannabis use, more abuse, can cause acute pancreatitis, although the exact mechanism remains unknown. And this was published in 2007, and that's actually fairly decent evidence that it can happen. It's a very low percentage, but it can happen. Cannabis has been known for centuries to increase appetite and food consumption. We get the munchies, I heard. A friend of mine told me that. In animals, the CB1 receptor antagonism decreases motivation for palatable foods. And this was a very important study because they were able to take animals that there was indulgent food for them and there was good food for them. And if they used this cannabis, they were hungry, but they more preferentially went for the good food. But when they weren't high, they went for the more palatable food. So that was kind of strange, I thought. There is this drug, Romanabant, is a drug derived from cannabis and approved in the EU for weight loss. It also was very strong in increasing HDL, your good cholesterol, reducing triglycerides, and increase in plasma adiponectin levels, which that's very important for glucose control. Surprisingly, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration has declined to approve Romanabant, I'll say it right, primarily due to its slight potential to enhance anxiety and suicidal thoughts. I think that sounds like a crock to me again, but it's slight, you know, they're not going to approve it. And there are a lot of people who this could potentially benefit because obesity, I think that carries, my view is it's probably going to carry a higher risk than is this drug. But there's also the concern about the litigious nature of our country, and that may be one of the reasons why they are not wanting to approve that drug. Because if somebody does commit suicide, having been on it, you know it's going to be a class action lawsuit and the company will be out of business. So it's also very good for anorexia, especially for patients who have very bad nausea and vomiting associated with cancer and AIDS. So it improved their appetite very much as well. It's also very effective for anorexia associated with light weight loss in patients who also had AIDS, and increased appetite, improvement in mood, and decreased nausea. There is evidence that cannabis, specifically the THC, has been used in the past for pain relieving, as a pain relieving substance in our history. Evidence does suggest that it may provide use, may prove useful in pain modulation by inhibiting neuronal transmission in pain pathways. However, again, these results do not support an overall benefit of THC in pain and quality of life in patients with refractory neuropathic pain. However, the first cannabis-based Sativex, which is a drug, has been approved for use for neuropathic pain due to multiple sclerosis in Canada. So there's not good evidence to suggest THC is good for neuronal pain, refractory neuronal pain, but with multiple sclerosis, it seems like it is. And you'd have to dig deeper into these studies. My point of this I'm trying to make is that the evidence is very conflicted. It's not strong either direction. But if you're a believer, it works. And I don't think we can underestimate the placebo effect, but I'm not really sure. And, you know, getting high just feels good, I guess. So my friend has frequently told me. This is cannabis, an inflammatory mediator, autoimmune response, demyelination, and axonal damage controller or mitigator, it mediates it in multiple sclerosis. CBD has been shown to exert potent anti-inflammatory and antioxidant effects. And so if you think about cardiovascular disease, atherosclerosis is essentially an inflammatory process. So oral treatments with low doses of THC help to inhibit atherosclerotic progression in the mice model. So let's go back and do a full circle and talk about the benefits of marijuana as it is described in the current marketing literature. It fights cancer, anxiety, and ADHD, relieves arthritis, treats migraines, treats glaucoma, epileptic seizures, prevents Alzheimer's, bipolar disorder. And you can see on the right more of that kind of stuff. Calms those with Tourette's and OCD. Helps relieve PMS. That's pretty impressive. That's an impressive item. Very impressive medication. Here we see health benefits of CBD oil. You can use it for, now this is of course for external use only, but it's been used for asthma. It's been used, again, I don't know how, you can't put it in an inhaler, I don't think. Cancer, brain, well-being, spinal cord injury, eyes, heart, intestines, stomach, bone structure. And here, this is a very interesting one because it talks about THC and CBD. So the THC is an orange dot, CBD is the green square, protects against cancer, both of them. Reduces nausea, both of them. Reduces pain, both of them. Causes drowsiness and increases appetite. Well, that's only the CBD. I don't know about you, but I've always heard that my friend, when he told me he got high, he got tired. So I don't know. I can't figure that out. Increases appetite. That's only the THC. Antidepressant relief, spasms. I mean, you just go on. I'm not going to say any more about it. It's even an antimicrobial and an antibacterial. We shouldn't be washing our hands with, and that's the antimicrobial is the THC. We should be washing our hand. We should just be scrubbing with weed. I mean, really. So, I mean, it concerns me. It concerns me, you know, as just a citizen, as a parent, as a grandparent. I'm sure there's many of you out there as well. I think that before we embark on using these products, we have to really think about Clark Stanley. We have to go back and really consider what some people will do to make money. Now, do I think there are health benefits to some of the, if they could perhaps synthesize certain elements of it? Do I think CBD oil does have some benefits? I think it does. I think it does for certain things. Well, I don't think we know what those are, but I don't think it's good for fighting cancer. I don't think it's good for all these other things. Smoking weed, whether it be, now is it the CBD or the THC, I really don't know, that benefits people with glaucoma by lowering their intraocular pressure, but can that be given in a different way? Can we, I mean, like I said, plants and botanicals and molds and all of this stuff, we have extracted different substances from them for years. Look at the opium poppy. The poppy that where we get the opium from, and then of course the heroin. It really just depends on the extraction, the processing, a whole bunch of things that go through that. And I think the substances contained in there do have value somewhere with some things, and probably even today have some value. If you have HIV AIDS or you have cancer and you're on chemotherapy and you're sick and you're retching and you can't eat and you smoke this stuff and your appetite comes back, then it works for you. And I think you should use it. Is there another way to, again, deliver it besides, you know, I mean, I guess they have edibles, but if you're throwing up, you don't want to eat edibles, so you have to smoke it. Is there another way to do this that works? Like a patch? I really don't know. I'm sure they're working on all these things. But to say that it does all of those things, which is in the contemporary, you know, sort of psyche of the public out there at large, I question the validity of all of this because the evidence is just simply not there. That's how I feel. So that's my talk. You get over the phone lines. John, any comments?
About this on so many different levels. Actually, I happen to know firsthand a lot about a lot of what you're talking about. Firsthand meaning close friends, family members, and it's all transpired in the last 12 to 24 months. I have friends who have serious cancer, and I have also, I can tell you a quick story about really something I don't think you mentioned. I don't know if you did, but a lot of this research started in the veterinary world, actually, for animals. Mm-hmm. The CBD, I'm talking about the CBD. I'm not talking about, I don't know much about, first of all, nothing to do with smoking it. I know all the benefits. It helps some people in certain ways. The psychosis things are actually beneficial. Seizures, people, appetites. But let me tell you what I do know firsthand, because I have friends that have done it and are doing it. I had last year a very close friend of mine who was diagnosed with a golf ball size cancer on his liver and in his lungs, out of the blue. And immediately was swept away to say, you need, you know, the cancer treatments of today, radiation and chemotherapy. He said, let me think about it. He made some phone calls to another friend of mine who had, I guess, connections. My friend went out to California or Colorado and got with a very serious, like you said, the refinement and the way that the CBD oil must be distilled, I guess. It has to be done correctly. There's so much out there now because it's not highly regulated. People are taking all kinds of stuff. You have no idea. If you get the proper stuff, and the point is, you're talking about different avenues of administration. When you have cancer or when you need high doses, I'm talking of CBD, non-THC, you need it to be given the correct stuff, and it needs to be given to you in a suppository, not just two or three drops under the tongue. That is good also, by the way. I have friends doing that. And I had a friend did the high dose THC that the place that he went to recommended under a doctor's care also, by the way. Took the CBD for 6 weeks, twice a day, through a suppository, came back to the doctor, both cancers on his liver and lung vanished, gone. Not just shrunk 50%. I know a number of people like that too. I do know it's helping people with their symptoms enormously. If you have radiation and chemotherapy and you take the high dose suppository, it makes the person feel a lot of the things you listed. They're feeling a well-being. They don't have the nausea. Their attitude, their outlook on life enormously improved. I know a friend who's been doing this now for 3 years and went off it for a few months. Drastic change, could hardly get out of bed. Went back on it, drastically back up, gardens every day. And basically the person is extremely terminal and has got cancer everywhere. But the way that it makes this person feel is remarkable. I'll tell you another quick story. We have a little dog. We have a Yorkshire Terrier mix with a Shih Tzu. 2.5 years ago, he's not very old, only 7 years old. One of his legs, he's almost stopped walking on it. He would hop around on three legs, barely put the one paw down, and I noticed it. We went to a vet, the vet took x-rays, said he's already developing early stage arthritis. And they gave us the typical pills for arthritis. What do you call it? The things all runners take.
The COX-2 inhibitors.
High dose, didn't touch him, wasn't helping him. I went online and bought some Celebrex. Other stuff to add
Celebrex.
To it.
That,
yeah, and wasn't touching him. The dog got to the point where he hardly would even want to walk around. He's lost his activity, was gaining weight. Went to another vet. We moved to another town. As you know, I'm a traveler. Went to a veterinary, said the same thing. Said, well, he's just got early stage arthritis. And so we were reading, and we went to, like you said, the CBD is basically legal everywhere you go. And it's in almost all of your grooming and pet stores, by the way. Again, you have to buy the right stuff. What we did, we give him 3 drops on 1 treat a day. Joe, this dog is a new dog.
It does have anti-inflammatory properties. It does. But it has to be, in that setting, on that dog, right? And I think that these stories are true. I don't doubt any of it at all. But you can't have something that works like that. But if the dog developed, let's say, diabetes, it's going to work on that too. The dog had some other one of these other syndromes that I had on there. It's going to work on that, got renal failure. It's going to work on that. I mean, you look at the list, John, and ridiculous side,
I'm just telling you. And so
it's an anti-diabetic. It says it right there, and I'll tell you something that's very important that people need to know is CBD, if extracted. CBD itself has psychoactive properties at all. Sure. So if you extract it from hemp, it's legal. But if you extract it from marijuana, even though it's just CBD, it's illegal, which is crazy. Now, the hemp has a higher concentration of it, and CBD is the same thing. It's the same CBD because it's the same, essentially the same plant. But it just, that was a side. But I think that, I think it does. I think the anti-inflammatory properties are there, but it has to be used properly in the right setting for the right problem. If you have psoriatic arthritis, which can cause enormous problems in your joints, and people decide, well, this works, this is what I'm going to take. You may feel better for real. You may feel better because of placebo effect. We don't know. It's never been studied, never been proven, never truly been vetted out. Or you may end up with a far worse disease than had you gone and gotten conventional medicine and not just relied on what could potentially be a good product for some things. I'll bet you Clark Stanley's ointment worked for people because there was huge demand for it. So people thought it worked, John. Can't argue the point. And well, there was tremendous amount of resistance to take it off the market. And it didn't have anything in it.
There's an 18 to 22% placebo effect with anything. So anecdotal, you have to take with a grain of salt. And I'll tell you the last two things. I have two very close family members who have had, one guy, he's about our age, he had an old football injury in his knee, and it's hurt him forever. And he works through it. He's a construction guy. And somebody else I know had a similar problem, just acquired over time as a foot orthopedic. I was going to a foot orthopedic person for a long time. Under the tongue drops, again, you have to get the proper stuff. Both people who were dealing with a lot of pain chronically, it is completely taken it away 100%. Now, when they go off of it, or in fact, one of my friends who has the knee problem decided, because he doesn't live near me, he decided, I'll just go to the store and get some other one. And he got some other one, and guess what? It didn't help him at all. He had to come back to getting, I just happen to know a really good producer of this in Colorado, mm-hmm. and it's under medical advice. You have to talk to a doctor and so on. And he does the pure, healthy, best distilled product of CBD. Mm-hmm. And, you know, these are three or four, 100% of my experience, and I don't need it personally, I don't have any issues, but everything that I've seen, it's all developed here in the last 12 to 24 months, mm-hmm. has helped. Now, I know several people who've tried it and several of their pets that they've tried it and it did not help them.
Mm-hmm. 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 Yeah, you know, it's just hard to say, you know, concurrent treatments with that and something else or just that and it just happens to work for them. You know, you have to have the right cannabinoid receptors right in your body in order mm-hmm. for them to work. Is there something that, you know, turns those on or makes them more receptive or less to, you know, the administration of that medication? You know, I simply, again, I don't know. But I do know that the research that's going on now may help to answer some of these questions. But I think that as a cure-all for 100 different diseases, and all you have to take is either this or that, mm-hmm. seems pretty far-fetched to me and irresponsible in regards to informing our public, our citizens, about treating themselves with what could be potentially, in their case, snake oil. Now, in somebody else's, it may be great, but I think we need to get science to vet this stuff out.
And finally, I think here in the last few years, I think that's happening. And it's always damaging to any medicine or product or any whatever that comes out. And it seems to cure some endless list of things. I mean, that's not helpful. Whoever thinks that they're helping promote their product or their item by saying, you know, there's almost nothing, it doesn't help, is almost completely shot themselves in the foot, because it's just not possible.
Well, no, they don't. It's not true.
And therefore, your product falls on its face.
People are desperate. They see that big, long list. Look, they saw that big, long list on Clark Stanley's product. I mean, it was for everything from lame back to toothaches. I mean, it was everything. And so it didn't hurt him. In fact, he was a rich man, very rich. And so that's, I think, what happens is that the money interferes with good public policy. And I think that's potentially happening. I'm not saying it doesn't work. I'm just saying that there is very mixed evidence as to the benefits and risks of, in particular, THC. I think CBD carries with it extremely low risk, if any. And so I think that's worth taking, even whether it works or not. I don't think it's going to hurt you. THC, on the other hand, I think is a different thing altogether. So, you know, but I don't think people should also believe that this is a panacea, that the CBD oil under my tongue is going to, it cured his cancer, it will cure mine. It will solve my alcoholism, or it will do something else. Because now, if it does, and it has a placebo effect on an alcoholic and they stop drinking because of CBD oil, look, great, take more. That'd be fantastic. But does that mean that really is what did it? And clearly the answer to that, I think we both agree, is no. There's no proof.
You know, back in the days of the gentleman you were talking about there in the history, because placebo effect is 18 to 22% of anybody who takes anything will have the suggested effect, without the media and all the other things to downplay it and stuff, word could get out very powerfully that I took this thing and it did such and such for me, you know, and the placebo effect has been around forever. And, mm-hmm. I do, back to the one person I know who's actually been taking the high dose CBD oil with suppositories for almost 2.5 years now. It has not cured this person's cancer, but it has made them feel enormously better. And mm-hmm. the coping aspect of it has been hugely improved.
And I think important. That's very important and very worthwhile, definitely. Definitely mm-hmm. something that, you know, and I'm glad for that. Certainly, whether it's, regardless of whether it's placebo, which I don't think it is, I actually think it does work. I think CBD has medicinal value. We just don't know how much. Maybe there's something else to it that needs to be synthesized or extracted. Maybe it has to be in combination with something else that we're just not familiar with yet. The route of administration may have something to do with it, how long it lasts and whether it can be time released. And there's just so many factors involved with developing and delivering medications that you just can't say three drops under the tongue works for everybody for all of this and that's it. I think we just don't know enough. But I do. I think it's an anti-inflammatory. Do I think it's an anti-emetic? Do I think it works to help people's appetites that they're in? I think the evidence for that's strong, and I think it does.
There's some pretty good neurological evidence in the area of seizures and things along with some psychological disorders. I know of in children, and maybe true in adults too. You know, under a doctor's care and given whatever it is you're supposed to take, whatever route you're supposed to take it and whatever dose you're supposed to take. I mean, if you just go off half-cock willy-nilly, like you're saying, I'm just going to take this and I'm, you know, never going to have a heart disease or kidney or whatever you think is going to happen, you have no idea if you're doing anything. But I mean, there's a lot of neurologists and people out there that really, you know, study the medicine part that are showing that, you know, so, but the studies need to emerge. We just don't, it's very hard to say, you know.
Right. I agree with you. There needs to be evidence, right? I mean, at the end of the day, there just needs to be evidence. Either the anecdotal evidence seems strong, mm-hmm. but, you know, I mean, there's really just no hard, fast, concrete evidence. And I understand that absence of evidence is not evidence of absence, and I get all of that, and sometimes it's very difficult to do these kinds of studies. But I don't see this as being that hard of a thing to actually study. So I do think that evidence should exist and should exist now or in the very near future supporting the use of cannabinoids for various different diseases that have enough power and weight behind them that people can say, yes, this is an appropriate use for this medication. I think it's going to take some time, John. That's how I think. But of course, it's legal, so people can use it how they want.
Let me ask you about the amotivation aspect.
Amotivational syndrome? That's a good one.
Yeah, for people who smoke, just the regular guy on the street who smokes marijuana. Now, you know, I would tend to believe there's some pretty strong, and most of the people that I ever knew that smoked frequently, they definitely had issues with motivation. However, I will tell you about two seasoned adults of age who smoke marijuana from morning to night like their cigarettes, and they thrive in their jobs and have no issues whatsoever. Mm-hmm. I know two people in my life like that, but I would say the vast majority of young kids that I knew when we were doing it, they suffered from some significant amount of what I would call amotivation. So mm-hmm. whether that's anecdotal or proven or not.
But that just may be their personality. And they gravitate to that drug because it reinforces their underlying psychology. You know, we don't know. Or it's because they started using it at an earlier age. Remember, the studies sort of reflected that. They started later, it didn't have that same neuropsychological effect. Mm-hmm. And so I think those are good questions. There's a question by Karen Pertuz. It says, do users of these kinds of therapies, more specifically probably the THC, not the CBD, But do they require larger amounts of hypnotics, muscle relaxants, and drugs when exposing, when they're going under anesthesia, basically? Do they require a higher level of anesthesia like you would find with chronic alcohol abusers?
Well, I don't know the answer to that, but I know we probably treat a lot of people in cardiac surgery nowadays that are frequent marijuana smokers, and I have never heard that, but I am not an expert. It's a good one to ask. But mm-hmm. What are your thoughts about that?
I don't know. Intuitively, and I'm just giving this as my best guess. I wouldn't think so. I think it's a different mechanism of action. So I don't necessarily think it would work. I think most of what they give don't really go to that same center of the brain, and certainly not with the paralytics. It's not going to have that effect. So I wouldn't think so, but I don't really know the answer, Karen. But if you send me an email to contact@perfusioneducation.com, I'll find out the answer and email it to you. So if you do that, I'll get that answer to you. So I'll ask an anesthesiologist probably if this would affect their anesthesia regimen or plan on a patient who was a chronic marijuana smoker or brownie eater or edibles or gummy eater or whatever else. I mean, it's amazing to me at how simple it is to use these substances now.
Yeah, I mean, it's really exploded on the scene here in the last 5 years or even the last 2 years, mm-hmm. with the accessibility of what and the packaging that they've come up with. It's just mind-boggling.
Yes, absolutely.
And the administrations of foods mm-hmm. and whatever they come up with, it's just mm-hmm. about limits mm-hmm. of the imagination, really.
And that's what concerns me, John. There goes the thing. This is, I guess I'm sort of really giving almost a social science lecture here versus just but I hope it was entertaining at least. My philosophy is just my philosophy, and I respect that you may feel differently than I do, but I do feel there is some value. I just don't think that value is really well understood, and I think that it's like a lot of things. It's being marketed in a way that is attractive and perhaps making claims that can't be supported by evidence, and therefore I believe there are desperate people who may be hurt by it, and that concerns me. And that's just my philosophy. Doesn't make me right, but it's how I feel. And I respect anybody that feels differently, because I think people have the right. We are a free will society, and they have the right to make whatever decisions they want to make and live free. So, that's how I feel.
Well, I think one thing is pretty conclusive, and that is on the young person developing brain, and probably have to stretch that to at least 19, if not 21, maybe in some people's cases. But mm-hmm. for a 13, 14, 15, all the way through 18-year-old young person to be smoking it with any type of frequency, they're kidding themselves if you think that it's not harming the permanent long-term development of your brain. There's so many studies on that have shown it. I know that, you know, people don't want to hear that and people don't want to believe that, but I think there's a ton of evidence.
I think the same thing.
I don't think there's ever been a study that hasn't shown that wasn't the case, actually.
It's the same with alcohol. It's the same with, you know, pretty much any drug. When your brain is developing, you don't need those things being added into the mix. It just confuses all of the processes that are taking place. So listen, so with all that said, I hope it was fun at least. Your talk was fantastic. I will look forward to seeing everyone tomorrow. We're gonna have Dr. Simpkins on, and he is going to be talking, what is the title of his talk specifically? Do you have it? Let me get the title, because it's a really good title. Yeah, it's a novel approach for, let me just pull it up so I say it, I don't mess it up. And tomorrow's Wednesday, novel approach for treating vasoplegia syndrome and shock. And he has a nitric oxide absorbing material. And I'm gonna ask him tomorrow whether or not, I haven't asked him already, and he's probably not watching now, so I feel like I can say this. I won't preview it to him. But I want to know about, if you remember the perf web we did with Dr. Platt, when he was talking about his heme particle, nanoparticle, that was basically heme in a glucose molecule that was very, very small. It was a nanoparticle that could be infused and perfused through clots, very good for ARDS, all of these things, because that molecule was able to move more freely. So it was like if you had an acute occlusion from a thrombosis, this particle could make it through that clot and perfuse the distal tissue, so you would reduce the size and damage from the stroke. And of course, that was an interesting talk. He was certainly very smart. And I don't know where that's going to, but it's interesting technology. So it was essentially an artificial blood that was different than what the other ones previously designed were and how it worked. So it was unique in the sense that it was this heme and glucose molecule. And now Dr. Simpkins is talking about excess nitric oxide production and how to control that, which is thought to be the cause of vasoplegia syndrome, which will lead to shock, of course, and being able to clear that is very beneficial in those patients. And he's a really super smart guy, been working on this project for probably 20 years. I know him very well, and he's a wonderful person, wonderful presenter. So I'm looking forward to his talk tomorrow. So maybe you could tune in, John. It would be great if you could and maybe ask a question, because I'm sure I'm going to have a lot of questions for him too.
Well, are you ready for this little bit of news?
Yeah.
I've been working on my thesis, and my thesis is vasoplegia following cardiac pulmonary bypass.
Well, I'll bet you'll watch it. I'll bet you we'll watch this program then.
Oh, I'm going to watch for sure.
Absolutely. And you too. You should watch it too. All right. I want to thank everybody. We'll see you tomorrow from 5 to 6 Central U.S. time. It'll be Dr. Simpkins, novel approach for treating vasoplegia syndrome and shock. I want to thank everybody for joining us. If you have any questions or comments, please email them to me. I promise I will respond to them. And we will, John, I can't thank you enough again. You're a gem, and I appreciate everything that you do for us. And I'm looking forward to seeing you again. And congratulations on the thesis. Hopefully you'll be able to, after you have had your opportunity to defend that, and you get your degree, you'll be able to share that thesis with us on this program. I would really love that.
Well, it'll be about a year from now, so it'll be great education for all of us tomorrow, and I'll be definitely tuning in and probably calling it.
I appreciate that so very much. Okay, everybody, see you tomorrow, same time, same